We have two more presenters, and the next presenter is Arpel Darsange.
I want to thank the Assembly for inviting me to your plenary session. And I want to say that it's a great honor to participate once again in perhaps the most democratic process ever undertaken in this country. And I also want to say I'm impressed by the quality of the presentations, and I don't envy your task ahead in terms of sorting this out. I take the position today that the wisest choice for this Assembly is to recommend a move from our current single-member plurality system to a single-member majoritarian preferential voting system. And just so that we're on the same page, I'm going to quickly describe what I mean by this preferential voting system. In such a model, an individual candidate would require 50% plus one or more support from their individual riding. A voter would rank the candidates on their ballot. If no candidate received 50% support from a particular riding, then the candidate with the least amount of support would be eliminated from contention, and that individual's number two votes would be redistributed to the remaining candidates, and the process repeated until someone received 50% or more support. So the next question is, why is a move to such a system the wisest choice for the Assembly to make or to recommend? And the answer is that such a move would be a safe option. And why, in these circumstances, would a safe option be the best option? And the reason behind that is that your mandate, as it stands, is very restricted. Your mandate prevents you from exploring perhaps other more attractive options. So I guess my advice is don't try to force a square peg into a round hole. And remember always that nothing is forever, that British Columbians can always revisit the process when they're given a mandate that's broader. So back to now why I think the preferential voting model is the safest model. And I have three reasons for that. The first is that there is little risk involved in moving to such a system. And this aspect of my talk will take up the bulk of the time. Preferential voting offers a number of advantages relative to the current system, but there are no real disadvantages relative to the current system. The same cannot be said of many of the other models. Such models may have far greater advantages, but also have disadvantages, again, relative to the current model. And I have an example, of course. I'm sure you're all much more versed in proportional representation than I am. But, of course, in various proportional representation schemes, you lose either an identifiable local candidate or you dilute local representation. I'm going to quickly outline some of preferential voting's advantages, again, relative to the current model. And I have four of those. First, it provides enhanced legitimacy to the elected MLAs. And this is a consequence of the fact that to get elected, the MLA requires at least 50% support from the riding. The second relative advantage is that you eliminate strategic voting and vote splitting, two concepts that I think are quite related. And this, of course, flows from the fact that voters can rank the candidates. Now a voter who supports perhaps an unpopular candidate or party, can feel free to do so, secure in the knowledge that if that candidate is eliminated from contention, their vote will be redistributed to another candidate. Third, I believe another relative advantage is such a move could raise the profile of minor parties. And that can occur because minor parties would be in a better situation to accurately gauge their popular support. And as a consequence, can use that to build momentum in future elections, because now people are free again to vote as they please. And fourth and finally, minor parties can play a greater role in policy development. And this may occur if a minor party gains policy concessions from a major party in exchange for encouraging their supporters to rank that particular major party second on the ballot. And the only disadvantage that I could think of, again, relative to the current model, is the fact that the ballot may be considered too complicated. However, I think that's easily overcome, whether it's through an education campaign or even just time. So to wrap this all up, a move to such a system, you gain something, and you may not gain much, but you don't lose anything. You're sure to get a better system as compared to the current system. And this is why I feel there's very little risk involved in a move to such a system. Now going back to, I have a bunch of lists here, going back to my original list as to why a move to a preferential voting model is safe, the second reason, because the first reason was little risk, the second reason is that such a model is consistent with our electoral traditions. Of course, this model is not foreign to British Columbians. We often see it employed, maybe slightly changed, but often employed by political parties when they select their leaders. As well, this province used this model in the 1952 and 53 general elections, provincial elections. And finally, the third reason why I think such a move would be safe is that it would be non-contentious. And it would be non-contentious for the very reason that there's little risk involved in moving to that system, and it's consistent with our electoral traditions. So to conclude, I want to emphasize that a move to preferential voting is not the answer to all of our electoral problems. But it does improve upon the current system without taking anything away. The same cannot be said of other models given your mandate. And I feel that British Columbians can consider more comprehensive options when we have the mandate to do so. Thank you.
Questions from members. Jim.
Thank you for your speech. Very good. One question. When you speak of your system, will this system bring out the voters per se more or less than what we've got now?
Of course, nothing's for sure, but I would like to think it would bring out more voters because of the fact that even if you support an unpopular candidate or party, your vote can be redistributed to another candidate, but you can still come out and be counted in terms of supporting that particular unpopular candidate or party.
Thank you.
One of the questions we received in advance from John Zoll: how can single-member preferential voting be implemented while at the same time ensuring minor parties are represented in the legislature?
The answer is I'm not sure if it can, but once again, the thrust of my talk is that relative to the current system, you don't lose anything. And as much as the current system will will help ensure that minor parties are represented in the legislature, so will this system. So you don't lose anything. But I'm not suggesting that you gain anything either.
Don't see any further questions from the floor. We have another question here, Sally DeLuna. Sally was very busy, actually, by the way. She had questions for everybody. The most deserving candidate might not win under a preferential voting system because the candidate with the most first preference votes could come out the loser when the second and third preference votes are distributed to achieve the 50% plus one majority. Isn't this unfair to the candidate with the most first preference votes?
I do not believe it's unfair to that candidate. In part because a move to such a system, every candidate would realize that getting a plurality of the votes wouldn't necessarily mean that you become elected to represent that particular riding. But I also think the better question is, how does a voting system map to the wishes of the electorate? And I referenced a paper here that talks about the election of single candidates, and in that paper they're talking about the U.S. presidential elections or the French presidential elections. But when electing a single member, at least according to the conclusions of these authors, the best system that translates these votes, that represents the truest wishes of the electorate, is this majoritarian preferential voting. But they agree that in all circumstances it may not be the best. But overall, taking into account all different circumstances, this is the best in terms of the truest reflections of the electorate when electing a single member.
Thank you. Margaret?
I guess I'm interested in what your view is of what the impact of this would be on the way that political parties function in the province. We have in the past had, both nationally and provincially, situations where the left or the right was fragmented, and so the currently federally, the liberals were the natural governing party because the right was fragmented for so long. And the same thing has happened on the other side of the spectrum. What do you think will be the impact of this on those kinds of politics?
Well, in terms of fragmentation, this type of system is well suited for dealing with that, in fact, because this is the whole matter of vote splitting. So now if an individual has a political, particular political persuasion, they can feel free voting for their first choice, but knowing full well that if their first choice happens to be knocked out of contention, that their second choice, that their vote goes to their second choice. And so in that sense, it can help consolidate that sort of fragmentation. I don't know if I answered your question.
Okay. Rob?
Thank you for your presentation. You've indicated on your sheet here that a PR system could possibly have constitutional objections. I'm not familiar with the preamble to the Constitution Act. Could you enlighten us on that at all?
Sure, and I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily a meritorious claim at all, but of course, people who have objections can always sort of file objections in court, and whether they're constitutional. But I guess what I'm thinking of there is, in the preamble, it talks of legislature sort of consistent with that of the United Kingdom. And so I guess someone could raise an argument that a move to a PR system is no longer consistent with the historic UK system. But again, I'm not suggesting that's necessarily meritorious.
We have another question that was sent in advance from Anna Rankin. Should the focus of the Citizens Assembly on recommending a system they feel is best for BC, or should it recommend a system that has the best chance of passing a referendum?
It's a really good question. I strongly believe that the Assembly should choose a model that they feel is best for BC, and have faith in the fact that the electorate has faith in this process and follows your recommendation.
Sam, are you this time asking a question or stretching? You're stretching. Okay. No, I caught that last time. Any other members? I have one last question here. If you can answer this one, you get a gold star. Because I think it's a matter of a mathematical question. This is from Wendy Bergerud. She's had it here for several people. This is the first time, Wendy, I think we've had a chance to ask it. What is the potential for perverse results in AV and STV?
And I guess I'll be answering the AV portion of that. But I guess it depends on how you define perverse results. A lot of people describe what happened in the last provincial election as perverse because of a party getting only 50% or a little bit more than 50%, essentially getting the entire legislature. Often people describe the previous election as perverse because essentially the second party formed the majority government. My answer to that essentially would be that I don't think this system would necessarily rectify that. But again, you're not going to do worse.
Wendy, is that what you meant by the question? More or less?
I'm not sure I remember why I came up with that one.
Wendy, you don't have to ask it.
But in terms of the historical record in the 52 and 53 elections, I don't think those results bear out any particular perverse results. The first election, the 52 one, was a minority government, and four parties had seats in the legislature. The second 53 election, again, four parties had seats, and there was a simple majority. And in fact, looking at the comparison, the beauty of it is, when you have a preferential vote, you can actually see what would have happened had there been a first-past-the-post vote. And in that case, the result was more proportional in the sense that if that election was run as a first-past-the-post system, two of the parties would not have even had seats in the legislature.
Yeah, Wendy.
I remember my question better now. I had to do, it's quite a technical question, actually. It has to do with the votes within a riding. And I recall reading about Condorcet and Borda and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of like you can end up with a winner from that particular riding that actually wasn't the, well, I can't remember all the details. I was reading about it, and it seemed like this could happen once in a while with both STV and AV.
It can, and I urge you to read that article that I referenced in Scientific American. Oh, super. And they go through the problems with this particular model, but in the end conclude that of all the different models in selecting a single member, that this is the best in terms of mapping the truest reflections of the electorate.
Thank you. And Rob, I believe, has a second question.
It's kind of a follow-up to one of the questions that you answered earlier. You were asked if you believe we should go with what we think is the best system for BC or the one that will get passed. And you said that you thought that we should go with the one that's the best for BC. And yet you recommend this one because you say it'll be passed, even though other systems may have other merits that may be better, and we can look at it later. So I'm kind of confused as to where you're going with that.
Yes.
Sort of.
Again, the thrust of my presentation was that not that it can pass, but it is the safest option, and that the safest option in this case at this time is the best option because your mandate is restricted. Because I think there are a whole host of better alternatives that you can't consider because your mandate is restricted. So why not choose an option where you can't lose, in my opinion, where you gain something but don't lose anything, wait till you get a mandate that is much broader, and then consider more comprehensive options.
Julie.
You mentioned, well, first of all, thank you very much for your presentation, Arpel. You mentioned something that's been brought up before, and whether it be with Ian McKinnon's gradualism and so on, that, well, this might be the safest or the option with less risk. I'm wondering if you and perhaps other people that have presented have the idea that we will have, or there will be, an opportunity again to look at or undertaking looking at electoral reform. I mean, the electoral reform undertaking in New Zealand and here in British Columbia appear to me to be fairly extensive and somewhat expensive undertakings. And I would think that whatever decision we make has to be a decision that is going to have the opportunity, either if we make a decision not to make a change, or if we recommend no change, or do recommend a change, it has to be something that I assume that will have the opportunity to be tried out for a period of time and perhaps with minor tweakings. But the idea of going in a direction that is safe and then trying something later, I guess the idea of trying something later, in what fashion do you mean that? I can't see this province undertaking something like this again anytime too soon.
And I agree, I don't imagine this province undertaking something like this anytime soon, maybe in a generation, maybe two generations, but whatever the case may be, I believe that a move to the preferential voting system is a good one because of the fact that there's a little risk. But then, again, the key is that it's the best choice because, again, your mandate is limited. If your mandate was very broad right now, I don't think I'd be standing here endorsing this. But it's because that your mandate is restricted. And so I would hope that in time a government would come forward and provide such an assembly with a broader mandate and hopefully allow you to actually consider more comprehensive solutions.
Thank you.
Harley.
It's like you want us to hold out for a new mandate, but I'm kind of curious, do you have a system in mind that's outside our mandate that you would want to explore? Are you talking the U.S. system? Or?
Oh, hardly. But in fact, I'd be scared if you recommended that. I don't have any particular system in mind. In fact, some of the systems that have been recommended, I might be inclined to support more if, for example, you could add more MLAs as well, and this is maybe beyond even just electoral reform, but more political reform, considering introducing an upper house. If one of the mandates for the assembly at a future date was to increase female representation in the legislature, well, then why not consider having two members from each riding, one woman, one man? I mean, that's a simple way to do that, but of course that's outside your mandate. Things like that, but nothing in particular.
Ken.
I was just wondering, because kind of what I'm getting out of your presentation is that your proposed system might not be a lot better, but it's no worse than what we have now. So the question is, and I don't think our mandate is that restricted, like STV and MMP and other variations are ones that are within our mandate. Are you saying that those are worse than the one you're proposing, or maybe even worse than what we have now? Is that what you're saying? Or?
I'm saying that those could provide far greater advantages, but will detract from the current system. And I'm sure you're more familiar than I am with the disadvantages of each of the systems in general, let alone relative to the current system. But I pointed out, for example, some of the systems have a lack of an identifiable local candidate. Other systems that you're considering will dilute local representation.
So you're kind of saying that this is the best compromise on all the factors that are important in this issue? It's kind of a compromise, is that what I'm getting?
Given your mandate, yes. And in fact, one problem I guess I have with the particular mandate is the fact that you're limited in considering only 79 MLAs and not more MLAs.
Sam.
It's okay. Harley stole my thoughts and he asked a question.
Arpel Darsange.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and other guests. I am not here today to try to persuade you to agree with me. All of you have independent minds, and I'm sure that you'll make good use of that. I'm going to offer you my point of view, and I have strong feelings about our electoral system and all the other aspects of governing. The purpose of electing or selecting members of the Legislative Assembly of BC, committee's been challenged to investigate what, in their opinion, might be the best option for choosing MLAs for our province. In reviewing that question, the purpose of having a legislative assembly or parliament must be considered. Electing members of the BC Parliament is not an end unto itself. Those persons chosen in some manner may assemble and offer their opinions at chosen times, but the purpose of the members is to permit the formation of a government from amongst those supported by the voters. Debate in the Legislative Assembly may be entertaining, enlightening, and important, but unless someone is listening and in authority to act on the matters discussed and decided, then there's little purpose in having the Assembly. Therefore, a government must be created from among the members chosen. The best manner for a government to be chosen is for a party to have a majority of seats in the Legislative Assembly and be called upon to form a government by the Lieutenant Governor and then provide the needed leadership required to conduct the business of the people of British Columbia. We have a lot of mythology associated with our system. One of the myths is that minority governments are good for the people in the province. History would suggest the residents of BC do not agree. Since elections were held along party lines from 1903, there have been only three instances of a minority government resulting from a general election. That was back in 1941 and 52. If the voters of BC believed minority governments was the preferred option, then the results of those elections would reflect that opinion. BC have elected, British Columbians have elected 28 governments since 1903. Of those, 25 have been majorities. A quick snapshot of the vote result since a 30-year period from 56 to 86. The winners are incidental. The number of votes by the winning party: 48%, 39, 41, 46, 47, 40, 49, 48, 50, and 49. Now, it's interesting that there's a lot of focus on what we call the popular vote. And one of the reasons we have the popular vote results is because the information is there, and the chief electoral officer and staff can tabulate it. But I would suggest that a lot of votes are not necessarily reflective of the support for a political party. A lot of people vote for the candidate, regardless of party. A couple of examples, if I may. W.A.C. Bennett was our premier for 20 years. He originally was a conservative member of the legislature, then a member of the coalition party, and then in 1952, he was a social credit, ran as a social credit. He was elected in all those elections because the people in the Okanagan were voting for W.A.C. Bennett. In Vancouver Point Grey, Gardy Gardam and Pat McGeer were Liberal MLAs for a number of years, quite a number, and then they joined the Social Credit Party, and they were elected in three subsequent elections. Now, the people in Vancouver Point Grey voted for Pat McGeer and Gardy Gardam because they all wouldn't simply change party because their members changed. Frank Calder was the member for the CCF and the NDP in Atlin, and then he later joined Social Credit Party and was reelected as because the people in Atlin were voting for Frank Calder. So even though the numbers are there, I don't think they truly reflect the necessary support for a political party. I don't vote for a political party simply because it's the political party. I might choose to vote for the candidate. So the numbers are not precise, nonetheless. Coalition governments leave much to be desired. Too often a small faction can hold the balance of power and use that to secure objectives considered important or urgent by a small number of people, but not always in the best interests of the general public. Since 1903, about 800 British Columbians have been successful in their quest for a seat in the Legislative Assembly. An examination of those chosen to take their place as a representative of those within their constituencies shows a record of community involvement, elected or otherwise for the most part. Traditionally, among the more established political parties, successful candidates must submit to a rigorous process beginning with the recruitment of supporters within the constituency organization, then to the nomination meeting, and from there to the election itself. Often the process may require commitment for a couple of years before the election. And during that time, these hopeful residents of BC will be submitted to close scrutiny by their peers, the media, and ultimately the voter. Only those with a desire to serve all the people in the riding are most often successful. The process soon eliminates those who might be involved as a lark or on a sudden impulse. While not infallible, it's a good test to determine sincerity and commitment of the candidates. A little more mythology. People will have you believe that our political premiers and leaders are lawyers. Actually, only about 15%, 10 to 15% of British Columbia premiers have been practicing law. Most were business people. In a democratic society, it's important to either avoid the tyranny of the majority or the tyranny of the minority. Population numbers provide the Greater Vancouver area with the majority of seats in any provincial election. That population and its power should be restricted to the Greater Vancouver area. Any residual voter's preference should not find its way into outlying constituencies where the preference of residents may not be consistent with those within a major metropolitan area. It's important for residents to have a sense of community and control over the results of an election within their riding. The determination of a representative should be in the hands of the voters within those electoral boundaries. British Columbia is made up of communities, large and small, and the attitudes vary greatly depending upon their choice of location. Do not impose an outside influence on our choice of choosing our representative. There will always be those that choose to march to the beat of their own drummer. Just because these extreme attitudes exist does not mean we should be subjected to their inclusion as part of our government system. Our tradition suggests minority points of view and extreme attitudes often can find a place within established political parties. Should others choose to believe only they have the answers, then they're destined to be apart and for the most part alone. That's part of life. Some jurisdictions have opted for different methods of choosing their representatives for a myriad of reasons over time. Their experiences are relative to those needs and their needs, but not necessarily the needs of British Columbia. Our system has served us well for more than a century. Those that participated in the political world of BC over those many years were not without knowledge and wisdom. What is the perfect system for electing members in BC? Well, there isn't one. Citizens of our province have been choosing their representatives for the most part of 133 years by permitting the candidate with the greatest support in a riding to represent the residents in Victoria. System was adopted from our federal system of choosing MPs and before that the traditional method of electing members in the United Kingdom. Over the centuries, many minds have considered the process, and while a multitude of changes have occurred relative to the details of the election laws in BC, the concept of having a winner as chosen by the people within a geographical area has remained constant. Would a system that incorporates the requirement of a majority of votes cast in a riding before a candidate is said to be elected improve our system? We've experienced the results of such an experiment under the alternative voting system in 1952 and again in 1953. That's where you wrote down numbers rather than you wrote down your preference, 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever. 1952, with the alternative voting system, there were 48 seats. The election resulted in a minority government. 4 members of the 48 were elected with majority on first count. 40 members, leading on the first count, finished first on the final count. 4 members who were second on the first count reached the first on the final count. 4 changes of the 48 with the alternative voting system. Again in 1953, 48 seats resulted in a majority government. 5 members were chosen with majority on the first count. 38 members were leading on the first count and eventually won. 4 members were second on the first count and went to the final count and won. 1 member was third on the first count and wound up winning on the final count. There were 5 changes in that election from the simple plurality. Some of our mythology. BC is subjected to... I heard this the other day on radio and I got so angry. And I shouldn't, but I did. BC is subjected to constant swings of the political spectrum alternating between left and right and right and left. It's absolute nonsense. Since 1903, we had the conservatives in power first for 13 years, and then the liberals for 12, then the conservatives again for 5, the liberals again for 12, the coalition for 7 years, social credit for 20 years, NDP for 3 years, social credit again for 16 years, NDP for 10 years, to the present day with the liberal. So it hasn't been, it's not back and forth. 10 years is a good run. 15 years, 13 years, that's a long time for a government to continue. It's inevitable in our system that the opposition one day will form government. It's very rare that a new party will come along and form a government. If we're to maintain confidence in our system, then the people of the province must accept the election results. There will always be those wishing to keep the political wars on fire between elections, and they have the right to do that. It's important that citizens of our province attract potential investors and that they have some confidence that they're dealing with a government that's going to be there for a while, not constant changes. Other people, anyone the province does business with, including the public service, they want to know who they're going to be working for the next period of time. They want to know what the policies are. When the election campaign's over, it should be over. And the chosen government gets on with the job. If you don't like them, kick them out next time. BCE, British Columbians, have permitted their governments to decide most issues of the day. Our concept of responsible government empowers those elected to government to govern within the authority of the people as provided to members chosen in general elections or by-elections. Seldom has it been believed necessary to go to the people by way of a plebiscite or referendum, but BC does have a short history. In 1873, voters were asked if they favored increasing the indemnity for MLAs from $5 to $7 a day. Voters said no. In 1909, voters were asked if they wished to have local districts or town with liquor laws. Those who voted said yes, but the government paid no attention to it. In 1916, voters were asked if legislation enabling prohibition should come into force. A majority said yes. The government then deleted the military vote, and it failed. In 1916, voters were asked if legislation should be enacted to extend the electoral franchise to women. 68% said yes. In 1920, voters were asked if Prohibition Act should be replaced by government liquor control. 62% said yes. 37 voters were asked if they were in favor of a comprehensive health insurance plan. 58% said yes. Nothing was ever done. Not until many years later. 52 voters were asked if they were in favor of the sale of liquor and wine by glass. 60% said yes. 52 voters were asked if they're in favor of daylight saving time. And said yes. In 1991, voters were asked if they favored a system of recall. 73% said yes. What the politicians didn't tell the people is it doesn't work. When there, another bit of our mythology is when there's a change in government, there's wholesale changes in previous legislation. Most governments introduce about 200 bills during their term of office. Upon being replaced by a new government, new party, it's most common to have about 6 to 10 significant pieces of legislation replaced, eliminated, or heavily amended. Back, going back to W.A.C. Bennett, he had the Two River system for Peace River Power, took over B.C. Electric, took over the B.C. Ferries. Very controversial, but no government changed it. And Dave Barrett with the NDP brought in the ICBC and Agricultural Land Reserve. Wasn't changed. There's the big difference between governments is administrative capability. Not legislative change, but administrative capability. And that's what people vote for the most part. Successful governments are made up of people with emotion, commitment, and desire. Personalities play an important role in providing leadership and success. Any system to choose our representatives that is simply an actuarial exercise would result in indifferent administration, devoid of vision, courage, and accountability, and would be unable to relate to the desires of individual British Columbians. I have a disclaimer. All of this preparation, including statistics and numbers, have been prepared by a fallible researcher. Any errors, however, are completely my responsibility. Thank you for your time. I appreciate being here.
Questions from members? Sam.
I'm just curious. You gave us a little history lesson on some politicians in BC history who jumped ship, so to speak, and were still elected. Do you happen to have any knowledge of those who jumped ship and weren't elected?
I'm sorry, those
well,
who...
Well, you made the point that you didn't believe that it was...
Those changed?
It was party-driven.
These people I know... And I knew what their history was. There may have been others who changed party and lost, sure. That doesn't happen that often, where people change parties. It doesn't happen that often. Most MLAs in our history were elected one time only. Most. But no, these people were successful, yes. There may have been others who weren't.
Jill?
Hi there. In your recent submission, in your submission, you say that the people of BC don't want minority governments, yet in the statistics you provide with respect to the vote share, it looks to me like it is more split. Like there's only one case where there was 50% of the vote, excluding the last election. So it may be that it's more of a function of the system that we have now, the first-past-the-post creating those majority governments, than the voters themselves not being more interested in a minority government or a more even split of the legislators.
I offer you my opinion. Minority governments don't work. They're not good for the system. The system isn't designed to accommodate minority governments. If you have someone responsible for an activity, whatever it may be, say management of a company or whatever, they have to be able to make decisions. They can't be constantly being second-guessed and subjected to changes every few months and that. It doesn't work. We have a system that has worked for well over a century. Minority governments, and I know some people think it's very popular, It's not part of our system and never has been popular. There's been a few federal minority governments. We've had 3 in BC. But the people, clearly, by their voting pattern, have said enough of this. The coalition governments came in the 1940s because they wanted a majority government. And the coalition party did well for 2 elections. And then they went to the alternative voting system and 1952 and 53. But there's no... I know it may be cuddly to some people, but minority governments don't work. I mean, why should a minority position be responsible for majority decisions? And another thing, if I may, minority governments and coalitions. I hear people talking about numbers. I don't know where this idea that we must have 50% or a majority comes in. I can understand it. But there's nothing in law that says you have to have a majority of vote to win a seat. Nothing. A person who wins with 49.9% may be just as capable as an MLA as someone who wins with 50.1%. There's no magic when you've crossed that 50% line. There are ways of modifying that, but what does it really prove, I wonder? How does that improve our representation? We could wind up with a lot of everyone's third choice. Go back to the conservative convention when poor old Joe Clark won on the fourth vote. And he was elected, and now what do I do? But anyway, minorities, I think, are not system. There are some questions that were sent earlier,
yes,
Jack.
Yes, I'm going to give you one of them right now.
Thank you.
I'm John Zoll. How might the current system provide better representation of minority views in the legislature?
Was that sent earlier?
Yes, it was, I believe.
Okay, minority points of view, if I may, please. Yeah, John, I haven't. What's a minority? One person? A couple of people? A few people? And why are people in a minority position? And I don't mean the obvious things. But politically, why are they in a minority political organization? I believe you will find because they want to be. They don't want to be part of a larger organization because they may no longer be in charge. They don't want to become most of the people in minority parties, and every party in BC is minority. There's no party in British Columbia that has a majority of people as members. So they're all minority parties, if you like. You have people who have a cause, and they have a few people who share that passion for that cause. They don't want outsiders coming in and diluting their enthusiasm. So they're a minority group, and they're happy as a minority group. You get people run for office. Suddenly they're elected. Many of them say, why me? A lot of people just can't take that pressure. That's why, as I said, the majority of MLAs have been one term. The minority opinion from anyone about anything. There's many ways of expressing a minority opinion. Public meetings, letters to the editor, radio programs, advertising, organizing, whatever you want. Doesn't mean you have to be in the legislature because you have a minority point of view. Big deal. I've got a minority point of view. If I had my way, I'd dump the Queen. But that may not reflect the majority opinion. I'd sell CBC, but may not reflect. Why should I be in the legislature because I have a minority opinion?
Take a question from Tannis.
I'm just wondering what percentage you would classify a smaller party as not being, quote, an extreme minority, having an extreme minority view. For example, in the last election, 12% of the population voted for the Green Party, and that seems to me that's a substantial proportion of our province.
Sure. And someone who's competed, say, in the Olympics, has come in fourth 20 times. You know, they're ahead of some people, but they're not winning. And that's the way it is. 10% is a significant number when you count how many votes that represents. But 10% is not a winner. And just because you have candidates and some people vote for you does not necessarily mean you should have a seat in the legislature. It's too easy. It really is too easy if we're going to allot, just because you have X number of candidates, you're guaranteed something. That too easy.
Norm, where are you?
Yep. I was just wondering what you think, since we're here and we have to pose something to the public. If we left the system as it is now, there isn't a referendum. Do you feel that we're disenfranchising the people of BC by not giving them a choice in doing that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether the people would be upset about it. I just don't know. They can have a referendum. I'm not trying to be a smartass, but believe me, it would be the easiest referendum to defeat politically in the province. It would be child's play to have it defeated. First of all, I don't know what possible question you could ask. That's why I mentioned these other referendums. The questions were obvious. Do you wish to enfranchise women with the same vote as men? That's easily understood. If you're going to have to sit down and ask people if they would like to consider some of these systems, then you're going to have to explain the systems. So it's very difficult. I'm not saying that there should be no changes at all. We've had dozens of changes over the years, maybe hundreds. If this were 1871 and there was an assembly to decide what kind of government we had in BC, everyone here, all the delegates, would be male British subjects over 21 and property owners. That's how it started. There's been changes, of course there's been changes. I honestly believe that the alternatives and choices we've been offered and people are considering, I don't believe it would improve the system. I think our system works. Not perfect, of course not. But I think it works. One thing I really am strong personally is I think if you're going to become an MLA, then you're going to have to work awfully hard to get there. I don't think it should be easy, because it's a very demanding job. And I think you should have to work for it. I don't know whether the people are that worked up about it. That, maybe you feel differently. That's fine. I know a lot of people. I talk politics all the time. And I don't... No one's ever come up to me and said, do you think we should change the way we vote? Maybe they're thinking that. But
we've got four more questions. We're going to try and get through them fairly quickly. Darren?
Thanks. You were wondering what constitutes a minority, and I guess for myself as an assembly member, I think some groups that might constitute a minority are people who live in rural districts, you know, relative to the Lower Mainland, people who live in the inner city who are at risk and maybe don't have a voice but need protection, seniors who maybe. Form a small percentage of the population but are in dire need of health care. Do you think that the system that we have currently addresses these kinds of issues very well, in that the do you think that votes are wasted and all voices are heard? And what I'm getting at is, do you think we can do better in any way?
When I was speaking of minority, I was speaking of minority political organizations, rather than minority of people, but for various reasons. There's no reason why people who are within identifiable minority groups cannot take part in the political process through established parties or a new party. It doesn't matter. One of the problems, realistically and practically, for political parties is if a faction takes over the party, then it can be destroyed because it's too narrow a focus on a specific issue. The people you mentioned, seniors and others, and it's a universal obligation of all political parties to be concerned, I think, about those types of minorities you mentioned. Some political parties have no opinion about that because they are focused on one issue only, and that's all they care about. Most of those minority points of view can find a place within a larger political organization. Somebody mentioned earlier today that present Liberal government's a coalition, Social Credit is a coalition, the NDP is a coalition. If you look at the history, that's absolutely true. These different groups and that got together. And very often a minority point of view will be heard, will be acted upon. Technically, in the legislature, a private member's bill is out of order. But it can be adopted by a member of government and put through. And a lot of legislation historically has started with a minority point of view by someone working within the system rather than throwing rocks from outside. Person has the choice, whichever they want, but just because a person's a minority point of view, I don't think they should be rewarded automatically.
Can we take one last question and we'll have a short response, of course. Jay, you're the last.
Can you comment on our current system and how it served us so well, how that relates to the current government in Victoria, and what do we do to solve the problem of no opposition?
I think we have the situation. We've had this before, by the way, historically in B.C. This is not the largest. We've had it on occasion where a government party has just been overwhelmingly. They got a problem of interfering with the decision of the constituents, how they vote for their representative. You got 79 seats, 77 Liberals were elected to the NDP. So in effect, you don't have an opposition not recognized as an official opposition. And the same thing has happened before in our history. In 1912, there was no official opposition. The Conservatives won. There were 39 seats, and they won 60% of the vote, and the opposition basically had nothing. That's just the way it breaks down. Is it all bad? It's certainly bad for the government, because a good government, in my opinion, results from fiery debate and challenges in the legislature. I don't know what they do over there, sitting there with two opposition members, and they talk to each other, and you know, but there's no emotion. You can't produce steel without heat. But the people in those constituencies voted that way. There's nothing prohibiting the people in the constituencies of our province voting 100% for a party. There's nothing prohibiting that. So at times you may not have an opposition, an effective opposition. But absolutely, and I'll tell you, as a former MLA, it's more fun with a tough opposition. You stand up there and make a speech and you're talking to your own colleagues. It's when the opposition start yelling and screaming at you and all that. That's when it's fun. If I may, one final point, Jack. If I could. I'm on a roll. I have nothing personally involved in this whole process. I'm not running again. I don't belong to a political party. But I'm interested in the system. I'm interested in the security of our province. One thing, if I could. People frequently are critical about the Legislative Assembly of BC. And you get these transplants. They come in from the Far East. Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. And they say, this is horrible. Well, go back home then. We have a legislature that's always been fiery. But British Columbia has been the leader in Canada of almost every social program that's been adopted. The Ombudsman, the Auditor General, all of these offices were established by a BC Legislative Assembly. We brought in some very good legislation over the years. And it's been in this atmosphere of confrontation and that. And that's wonderful. If you can't stand it, then too bad. But when you bring a piece of legislation forward in BC, you better be pretty confident that what you're doing is correct. Otherwise, under normal circumstances, the opposition will destroy you. And you'll wind up withdrawing the bill because you really can't support it. So, the favorite line is, the legislature is not a place to take grade 7 students. Well, then don't bring grade 7 students. The legislature was not designed for school children. It was an alternative to war. So naturally, you're going to have heated debate. And you've got personalities. I would not like to see our system sanitized so we don't have personalities. Because even though people may think certain personalities are a little bit off, surprising how effective they can be. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jim, and we again want to thank all presenters. The idea was to focus on some key electoral values, key electoral issues, and we've certainly done that with our 9 presentations. And again, we thank our 9 presenters. We're going to have nothing but a 5-minute break. 5-minute break, an exercise or whatever, get outside and get one gulp of fresh air. We're back here at 4:15, and we're going to have one more hour, and then you can see the hockey game.